You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. Today my guest is Robert Antoni. He's the author, most recently, of the novel Blessed is the Fruit, published by Holt. He's also the author of Divina Tres, published by Overlook Press, Tusk, and paperback, and he co-edited an anthology of New Caribbean writing called The Archipelago. To begin with, Bob, where were you born?
In Detroit, Michigan, quite by accident, because my parents were on their way from Trinidad, and my father's in medical school, and we ended up in the Bahamas, which is where I grew up.
And so the place that you call Sangre de Cristo, is it?
Corpus Christi.
Corpus Christi.
Right.
Some bit of the body or the blood. Is Trinidad, in fact?
It's based in part on Trinidad. Trinidad more than anywhere else, but I like to think of it as my own fictional ground, and it could be anywhere in the Caribbean, but probably is most similar to Trinidad.
Now, I find myself making a distinction on this show a lot, that there'll be writing that is, say, Asian writing, and then there'll be Asian experimental writing. And I'm more interested in the experiment than in the report. In a sense. And so I was immediately struck in reading these two books that the first book is, in a sense, divided by a mirror. There's a page that is a piece of foil so that as you're reading, you see yourself suddenly. And the second book has in it a piece of plastic that represents a window. It's divided, in this case, by a window. And I wanted to ask, because it seems, you know, as if a lesson in mimesis, the mirror, the window, what are these things doing in your books?
Well, I could probably talk for each of those for about an hour. But I guess I'll start with the mirror first. The mirror divides the book in half, and both halves are mirror images. In the very center of Divina Tres, I do a retelling of the Hindu myth, the Ramayana, and take over from my narrator with an interpolated tale of the Ramayana, which is Hanuman, the monkey god's story of the monkey tribes, which I tell in my Caribbean monkey language. And so for an instant in the very middle of the book, the reader as monkey sees his or her face on the page.
Monkey see, monkey do.
Yeah, precisely. And the book is in many ways about a search for a Caribbean identity. And there are all sorts of wonderful reasons why a mirror might be nice in terms of sort of postmodern theories, which I'd prefer to leave for others to talk about. What I like to call the glass page in Blessed is the Fruit, the new book, is also kind of the absent center. Blessed is the Fruit is very much about dissolving boundaries. And, you know, I have two narrators, one black and one white, two female narrators, one mistress and one housekeeper. And the languages, the stories are kept very carefully separated. I think the way that history has kept these stories separated, of course, they're not in any way separate. They overlap. And this glass page is the is the boundary which the reader cannot help but cross. That glass page cannot help but be shattered by the reader because the stories could never be kept separate.
Now, in both books, Divina Trace, your first novel, and Blessed is the Fruit, the new one, you are largely speaking in the voices of women. Mm-hmm. And there is that boundary or barrier, too, which is being dissolved here. And because eventually I'm going to ask you to read a section about a rape, I wanted to speak about where the co-optation is impersonation, where it is an act of love, and where it's an act of violation.
As a writer, I'm most interested in finding a way to get myself out of the way and letting my character speak. And the farther removed they are from me, in some ways, the more interested, the more compelled I am in inhabiting, you know, those characters, those voices. You know, for me, the act of writing is finding a way to let them speak and let them determine ultimately where the story is going. That's when I feel like I know that I'm onto something, when they start doing things that I haven't planned for or it's not in my best interest that they do those things. The book takes a turn, and you know I have to follow it. In every case, these characters are people, you know, that I grew up with, and sometimes there are combinations of various persons. I do lots of recordings. I have hours and hours of the two women that Blessed is the Fruit is based on. Lila is a great aunt of mine, and her servant, it's a woman by the name of Clarine, and I have hours and hours of their stories. And I listen to those tapes over and over and over again, and suddenly they begin to speak through me, you know, in the writing.
I thought we would hear one of the voices. This is a section from Blessed is the Fruit by my guest Robert Antoni. Would you like to put
it
in context?
I'm a little worried immediately about the idea of this being labeled in some ways a rape scene. It is a rape scene, but in a sense the character doesn't really realize that she's being raped, and Barry, the male character's, I would have to say that he's not even aware that he's perpetrating this rape. These are two young kids, 13 and 16 years of age, and you know they're living in a remote village in the Caribbean. Val, the female character, has been running from Barry for some time, and he finally here catches up to her. I'll go right ahead and read this section. This is in the voice of Val remembering back to a time when she was 13. "'Cause my grandmother, she uses to go at church regular upon evenings, church meeting or choir practice, something so, you know, she always doing something inside that church. My grandmother go with she boyfriend, Lambert, and I uses to go with them and visit with my cousin whilst they in the church. Because I would go to church with them upon Sundays, but not upon evenings. Children didn't uses to go church upon evenings. But my cousin living cross from the church, the big Baptist church, and I could visit with she. So when 10 o'clock come and my grandmother and Lambert going home, they call me out from my cousin house. I just run and catch the bike and I go along, because Lambert uses to drive bicycle and he would, you know, put my grandmother to sit upon the front, upon the crossbars, and he ride in the pedals and they going along like that. So I there talking with my cousin, it getting late, past 10 now, and I hear glurring, glurring, Lambert upon he bell. My grandmother called, say time to go home. I was just waiting to hear she voice, and I bawl, I coming, and I run out to catch, you know, whole defender and running behind. I notice nothing particular, my grandmother sitting upon the crossbar. She wearing she broad hat that she uses to wear at church, and Lambert driving the pedals. Onlyest thing is they moving a speed tonight, fast, but I could run fast too. So I just catch the fender and run in behind. Quick now, Lambert, shift in the dark. Shift in the dark, quick, quick like that. Darkness of them canes side the road. I was thinking this very strange, that he shifting in the canes. What Lambert going in them canes for? One I could suppose maybe my grandmother want to use toilet, you know, something like that. But one I ain't thinking nothing particular. Just hold upon that fender and running behind. All in a sudden, I notice, I say to myself, well, my grandmother looking very big tonight. She looking very big and tall tonight. When Lambert stop and my granny hold upon my arm tight, tight. When I look up in my granny face, I see this vagabond, his very self dress up ganga, and there driving the bike is he friend Louis. I say to Louis, wait, is you again? Barry was wearing he own grandmother broad hat. He had on this wig that he get from some place. He wearing this wig. He got on earrings and bracelet rings upon he fingers. He wearing he grandmother long dress, old-fashioned long dress with them big pump sleeves, big apron, so that could fit he like that. Big tall red man like he dress up in he grandmother clothes ganga. Well, I say to Louis now, because I know Louis, he living across the street from me. I say, Louis, man, why you drive this man bike for me to hold on like that? You know I ain't want nothing to do with this beast. Louis say he pay me to do it. He give me money, pay me, and you know with money anything goes. You know that. Barry jump off the crossbar now and Louis gone. Left me with this vagabond. I say I ain't talking with you. Ain't talking with you no matter what you do me. He say, wait. I go through all this to get to you, dress up myself in ganga, and you ain't gonna talk with me? He say, you think that I would go through all this and let you go so easy? I was thinking, well, you can't fight with he, big tall man like he, and strong. So I say, talk then. Talk then what you want, because I can't fight with you. So then he talk, talk, talk. He talk. But I ain't answering he nothing. I ain't speaking a good time. Last I say, you does bully everybody to talk with you like this? He say, no, I don't just bully people. I say, well, what you doing with me now, then? You don't call this bullying? This is bullying. This ain't love. He say, I just feel something for you. I say, well, I didn't feel nothing for you. I feel when I look in your face, hatred like I won't kill you, or you gonna kill me. He say, you just keep quiet, or let me cuff you in your mouth. I say, I know you gonna cuff me in my mouth. That's all you could do is cuff. He say, why you keep telling me them things? Why you keep telling me them things make me mad and running from me? I say, what you gonna do with me now? He say, I ain't gonna do nothing more than you ain't do already. So I say, well, you just do it quick and let me go, because onliest thing I want is to get away from you. Because, Bullum, I didn't had much of experience, not much, but I had enough to know sex is the firstest thing they does go for, the firstest thing. I accustomed to that already. But truth is, I didn't think that's what Barry did want from me. I didn't think that for a minute, not 1 second. Amount of bright-skinned girls going at the high school would give he that. And anyway, you don't just afraid for that. You more afraid for he to do you some meanness, cut you up and beat you. Because you know them people with money always want beat up the poor ones like that. They always doing like that. You don't just afraid for sex. That's just something you got to put up with, something you got to bear, and you getting accustomed to that already anyway. Barry say, now you gonna give me trouble tonight? I say, I'm gonna give you no trouble, but if I give you anything, make this the first and the last, because you and me ain't no company. He say, oh yes, you very easy to say make it the first and the last, you won't get away. I say, yes, I won't get away, onlyest thing I want is to get away from you. Well, he didn't answer nothing to that, and I didn't talking nothing more neither. He just pushing me, walking me through them canes, push me deeper in them canes. So now I think, well, look, you could just give up, as he's so tall and strong, you can't do nothing to get away from he. And plus I was thinking, well, if he could put himself so low as to dress up himself as woman, dress up himself as Ganga, only to get to you, maybe something there in that. Then he lie me down upon some dead canes. He find some place soft in them canes for we to lie. Now he start to feeling me up, but not so rough, more gentle now, and I kinda relax. I say, leastest thing you could do is take off that wig, that broad hat and them earring. I say, you look like a fool. He did embarrass now, so he take off he ganga clothes, he start up again. I just relax more into it, don't fight with he too much, and I did start to like it this time. You know, he was feeling me up, but gentle, gentle now, and I just go soft inside. Down there, I just go all to waters. Deep blue and purple, warm, wistful waters. And he raise up, and he go inside, he hold a he warm inside, and I just melt down soft into it like that. Easy, not fighting now, and it did feel good this time, and he did know I was liking it too. When he finish, you know, he laugh and think, I laugh, I feeling good now, not so bad. We talk and think, we laugh little bit, he ain't holding me no more and I ain't running neither.
Robert Antoni reading from his new novel, Blessed is the Fruit. Now, that's quite an act of ventriloquism, both literary and performance.
Yeah.
And, of course, in this section, the man is dressing in woman's clothing, is transvesting. Is this an act of literary transvestitism?
Yeah, I mean, it's all of those things. You know, it's also the story that Clarine told me that, you know, was the origins for it. The truth is that, you know, the book is about dissolving among all of those other categories that I've mentioned, race and gender, race and class and monetary boundaries. It's about erasing gender boundaries. And actually, Barry finds out that he quite likes dressing up as a woman. He does this a few more times. And actually, Lilla, Vel's counterpart, her husband finds that he also likes this idea of dressing up as the other sex. So there's a lot of this going on.
The stories also seem to go in disguise. For instance, this story reads like a disguised version of Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah.
One appearing as the wolf appearing as grandmother.
I actually bring that up at one point, literally. I think it's Vel who says something about Barry coming to the door like the wolf, dressed up.
So then is a culture story, is this in some way, what is the relationship between the work you're doing in oral history to anthropology? Is this fiction as the gathering of tales?
In every case, you know, all of these things kind of surface in the text, and I don't hold them back. But all of those allusions are there. Simply because this is a Caribbean tale doesn't mean that, you know, the whole world cannot be brought to bear in this tale. And, you know, I would like to think that there are all of those echoes going on. Sometimes it's much more explicit when I do the monkey chapter in Divina Trace. The reader knows that I'm sort of bringing in all of this stuff from the outside. But in a scene like this, I mean, those allusions are all there, not necessarily on the surface, but you know, they're coming. They're welling up from someplace down below.
Now, when you assemble an anthology, as you have in a recent issue of Conjunctions magazine, the issue is called The Archipelago, New Caribbean Writing. What is the... Are you introducing these writers to an American culture, Are you presenting a certain kind of writing other than geographical? Is there a systematic kind of choice in what you've chosen to include? Could you talk about
that? Well, it's in some ways the opposite of systematic. I wanted to be as absolutely open as possible with the conception of the Caribbean in this anthology. And in fact, the Caribbean is a huge geographical space that is hard to demarcate and has further the idea of a geographical space has further been confused and in some ways very much energized by the dispersion of Caribbean peoples all over the world. I mean, we would now have to talk about New York as a Caribbean space, as certainly Miami is a Caribbean space, as Toronto, as all of these places. And I wanted to represent as much of this as possible. I wanted to do things like put Derek Walcott beside Garcia Marquez, which to my mind no one has ever done, but clearly these are two Caribbean writers. Garcia Marquez always talks about himself as a Caribbean writer, but sometimes I think because he writes in Spanish and Walcott's writing in English, they're kept separate, and this was the kind of boundary that I was looking to cross. I wanted to put people like Wilson Harris in that company. He's a writer from Guyana who may not be well known to many Americans, and he's been doing brilliant, absolutely postmodern stuff before anyone ever thought to call it postmodern.
As a matter of fact, of course, when writing a book listing the 99 modern works that are essential, Anthony Burgess included Wilson Harris's quartet.
Sure. And then I wanted to put these older males with a lot of the new young writers, many of whom are females, with Christina Garcia, with Rosario Ferre, with Edwidge Danticat, show in what direction Caribbean writing is taking. And we introduced several relatively unknown writers, such as Adrian Castro, who's a wonderful performance poet from Miami who speaks several languages at once.
Now, given the postmodern nature of your own work, and given the fact right now that it is likely, as a public is discovering more and more of the world of literature, of its variety, it is likely that this public embraces the personal narrative, say, in the case of Asian writing, of Amy Tan,
sure,
before it will more experimental or more difficult forms. So as an anthology editor, do you feel a resentment toward the less experimental, the less literary offerings that you include?
Well, I think in most cases, my obsession is with and my interest is with language and form, and in every case I think the writers that we've included, I of course co-edited this with Brad Murrow, the writers that we include are all interested in language and in form. In terms of my resentment, perhaps from readers, publishers who would like to sort of cage experimental, in quotation marks, writing as something that's that's in some ways to be not to be regarded highly or not to be paid too much attention to. Certainly, I find that very difficult. In the other arts, experimentation is applauded. It's looked for. You know, the new is always the most exciting. It's disconcerting for me that in terms of literature, it seems to me we're as readers, as publishers, as an industry, in many ways, very conservative. The new is taken to be, in some ways, suspect, and only after it, you know, only after the test of time. For example, Wilson Harris's writing, he just kept doing it until people couldn't ignore it any longer. Only then is it embraced, which is problematic. And you know, I hope we could get beyond, at least be more open to newer forms, and writers who are actually pushing you know, writing into you know, whole new worlds of possibility, you know, pushing limits. This is the writing that I'm interested in. It's the writing that, you know, writers like Salman Rushdie speak about. I mean, the writers who push their forms to, you know, to the edge and even risk falling over it.
I've been speaking to Robert Antoni. His newest book is Blessed is the Fruit, published by Holt. He's the author as well of Divina Trace, published by Overlook Tusk, and he's the editor of an anthology of Caribbean writing. It's a special issue of the literary journal Conjunctions, number 27, called The Archipelago. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Jennifer Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse, Pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.